listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. It's looking like the pieces of a puzzle are falling into place with the assassination attempt against Maduro, what, about a week and a half ago now. Let's see, Colombia, like within a couple of days, announces it's going to leave UNASUR. You have all of the efforts to try to isolate Venezuela that have been taking place in the U.S.-dominated organization, the OAS. And where the resistance has been taking place, you've had a number of places that, you know, are U.S. puppets, basically, making trouble, either leaving the organization like Colombia wants to do, and they're trying to, you know, this thing that was like the home of all the South American nations are trying to break that up. And in other places, you know, like they're trying to evict Venezuela, like they did with Mercosur.
Yeah, Mercosur.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's obviously a very clear pattern everything that's happening. And as Daniel Ortega put it in a recent interview, if the United States wants somebody to do what they want and they refuse to, then they just get subject to a systematic attack,
right,
starting with diplomatic moves, economic sanctions, the psychological warfare, economic warfare, and the threat of military intervention, one kind or another. And so what, in the case of Venezuela, and if you look at what's happened over the last 3, 4, 5 years, ever since 2013, when President Nicolas Maduro took office, there's been the diplomatic assault, the economic assault, the intensification of sanctions against individuals in the Venezuelan government. And now you move to the point where there's been an assassination attempt because everything else has failed. They haven't been able to get what they want via diplomatic and economic sanctions. So, and you can be absolutely certain that the United States in some shape or form is behind this recent assassination attack. And even if they aren't behind it materially, they've been providing the moral context and the encouragement for it, the incitement to it, through their relentless and extremely virulent psychological warfare campaign against the government of Venezuela.
Right.
So then there's that. And then in countries where they happen to have a friendly government in power, they take what one might see as preventive measures. Like in the case of Argentina at the moment, the continuing judicial, what some people call lawfare attack on Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner continues. She appeared in court today answering her in the same way that Lula da Silva has a judicial antagonist in the shape of that guy. Is it Silvio Moro in the Brazilian prosecutor who's made a career out of attacking Lula da Silva? Well, you've got this guy called Claudio Bernardio in Argentina, who's the judge who's pursuing Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. So what's happened, the most recent prosecution, successful prosecution, has been against a guy called Amado Baudo, who was Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner's vice president. And in exactly the same way as Jorge Glass, the vice president of Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and who was actually the vice president of the recently elected president there, Lenin Moreno, Jorge Glass was convicted on entirely circumstantial evidence. There was no material evidence against him. And he was essentially jailed on the word of somebody that couldn't be substantiated. And the same thing happens in this case with this guy, Amado Baudo. There was no concrete material evidence sufficient to convict him. And he was just convicted on the say-so of what they call the arrepentidos. Now, arrepentido means somebody who says they're sorry, or somebody who's recanted.
A penitent.
And it's a term loaded with historical significance,
right?
Because you may well know this, Don, and arrepentido was the term that was applied to people under the Holy Inquisition.
I did 9 years of Catholic school. I know exactly what it means. Yes.
So and so people who are subject to torture by the Inquisition, who subsequently said, "Oh yes, it's true.
I did it.
Very bad. I did naughty things with the devil. I'm very sorry."
Yep.
And they were called arrepentidos. And so this figure of the arrepentido has reoccurred in our contemporary Latin American politics, but this time it's applied to people who are put under pressure. They may not even be guilty of any crime, but because they're put under pressure, they make declarations just to have the authorities leave them alone in many cases. Because they're seen to have been cooperating with the authorities, they're allowed to go free. And it's that kind of extortion, this kind of judicial extortion, that's been applied in all these cases that we've looked at over in recent months. The case of Jorge Glass in Ecuador, the case of Lula da Silva in Brazil. Now this case of this guy, Amado Baudo, the former vice president under Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And now they're going after Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner herself on the basis of what? Well, this is the case in which she was asked to appear this time has been called the case of the Cuadernos. Now, a cuaderno in Spanish is an exercise book, like a school book. And the term refers to some notebooks in which a taxi driver, get this, Don, a taxi driver who used to drive functionaries around of the Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner government, allegedly took notes. And in those notebooks, he took a record of all the places that he went to and what he alleges that he learned in the course of driving all these government functionaries around from one place to another. Now, the interesting thing about this is that he's lost the cuadernos. He says that he's burnt them. But it's on the basis of what was allegedly in those cuadernos that the judicial authorities are going after Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Mm. Right? Now, this guy, this taxi driver, is somebody who's already been declared legally in a previous trial some years ago in a case, in some other case. I can't remember exactly what it was about, what it was about. But he was declared formally by the court concerned to be an unreliable witness. Okay? So this is the guy who's saying that he made some notes that he just happens to have burned, so they don't exist anymore. And it's on the basis of what he's saying that various people have been detained. The authorities have put pressure on those individuals to make declarations. Some of them have made declarations and been allowed to go free.
Right.
And some of them haven't made declarations and remain in detention. But that is the basis on which this trial is going forward.
You know, it's so similar to what's going on in the United States right now and what went on in Brazil. It's evidence? Who needs evidence? Look, we have plenty of evidence, okay? All of these people have seen it and they're convinced it is true. I just can't show you. It's the way we gather it. Oh, the dog ate it. I burned my notes, you know, whatever. For some reason, they can't produce anything to prove their case, but trust me, it's true that the enemy, the people who are unfortunate enough to be on the wrong side of this all the time, all for some reason tend to be on the left.
Well, in this case, a lot of the people who are implicated in this are members of either they're business associates of Mauricio Macri, because Mauricio Macri himself is one of Argentina's leading business people.
Right.
So either they're business associates of Macri or they're actually members of Macri's government. But what happens to them is they turn up to the judges and say, oh, nothing to do with me.
Right.
And they say, oh, that's all right, then you can go.
That's right, you can go. This is what we saw in Brazil, too. It's the same thing. You've got the actual crooks were all excused, and then the president, who had nothing to do with any of that crooked stuff, she gets kicked out because she put money in this column instead of that column that had nothing to do with crime or any benefit or anything else for accounting.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Brazil is that, for example, Eduardo da Cunha, who was the president of the lower house in Brazil's Congress, and he was one of the driving forces behind the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff back whenever it was, 2016, I've forgotten when it was now.
Yeah.
But he's been locked up for corruption charges. But what that looks like is a kind of an internal kind of vendetta within the Brazilian right wing. And somebody decided it was payback time for da Cunha. But, you know, and the idea that there's some kind of impartial justice in any of all this, in any of these countries, is ridiculous.
Well, let's go to the question of impartial justice. In the United States, which is supposed to be, this is the country that lectures the world, China, Russia, all kinds of places, on making sure that there's a stable political environment for investment. Rule of law, that's the term of art that they use, and they rank countries around the world on it and themselves at the top. And it's over things like this. When, for example, you have 16 out of 18 hijackers that plow planes into $2 billion buildings, kill 3,000 people and change, also, by the way, take a chunk of the Pentagon out, and now the survivors are looking to sue someone, when 16 of those 18 are Saudis, of course Saudi Arabia can't be sued because it's protected by the doctrine of sovereign immunity that protected them for a dozen years or so. Finally, that changed in the last year or two. Instead, they sue Iran because someone once had, like, the word Iran come up in their alphabet soup or something. That's how remote the connection was. They sue Iran and get a multi-billion-dollar judgment against Iran in an American court in New York. So that finally is unwinding some, but they tied up Iranian assets for years over that. Yes. And now, and it looked like they were actually going to try to sell off, you know, $2 billion worth of Iranian assets to pay to the survivors of 9/11 when Iran had nothing to do with it. Right. Now we have this gold company, a Canadian gold company, that was a successor to an earlier Canadian gold company. It's Crystalex, it's called. Yeah. And they, there's a, like a history that goes back, who was it, the old Brit that was lost for Sir Walter Raleigh, with he was beheaded for inciting war with Spain, but he had a really bad luck as a consequence of trying to go get gold. Right. In this same area. Well, this Canadian firm, Placer Dome, tries to open up this gold mine in Venezuela, and they don't. It's, the gold is of low quality. It's expensive to extract, but there's a lot of it. You have to wait. What they do is they play the margins. When it costs $50 an ounce to extract the gold from the mine, if the price is $100 an ounce for the gold, then you do it. Or, sorry, it's $500 an ounce to extract and $1,000 an ounce on the market back in the about 10 years ago. They never got around to doing it, and Hugo Chavez got impatient. They wanted to try to get some money for the state out of this, and they flipped it, the contract, to this company, Crystalex, and said, however, we're going to be doing a very tight environmental review of this property because people have been going up there for decades and polluting the hell out of it. People were what they call the wildcatters, were going in there. Right. There were like little wildcatter bergs with no sewage and all kinds of environmental devastation. These knuckleheads shaking their it's in the water, looking for gold nuggets, and like it was San Francisco in 1848 or something. So the environmental review process was going to be a serious one. Well, they never passed the mustard for the environmental review. Crystalex never performed for the environmental review to the satisfaction of Venezuela's government, and so they weren't able to develop it. They turn around and sue Venezuela, saying that your failure to provide us with the required approvals was, in essence, a taking of, an eminent domain taking of our property, an expropriation of our property, and we are entitled to arbitration under the contract for that. They went to an arbiter in Washington, D.C., of course, who said, yeah, they owe you $1.2 billion. And so this company, this Canadian company, Crystalex, goes to court in the U.S. and gets a judgment in the district court in Washington, D.C. for $1.2 billion. They then tried to execute this judgment, and this past week, in the midst of, within days of both the assassination attempt against Hugo Chavez, against Nicolas Maduro, the announcement of the withdrawal of Colombia from UNASUR, which people are looking at is indicating that we're going to hear the same from Peru and some others. You know, the American allies are trying to tank this organization. But then we suddenly hear from the U.S. District Court in Delaware, from a judge there who was an Obama appointee, that, yes, they can execute the judgment against the property of Venezuela and the United States that they can reach, known as CITGO.
Right.
So this cash stream that's been going to Venezuela has actually been interrupted by the U.S. courts already, is going to be essentially taken from Venezuela and handed to these guys because they weren't allowed to contaminate the area around this gold mine.
Yeah, I know. And as we were saying earlier before we started the our conversation, it's a mystery to me why Venezuela left themselves open to that possibility.
Yeah.
Because, and it's been clear for years, hasn't it, that the United States is going to very aggressively go after Venezuela's assets in the same way that how the vulture funds went after Argentina's assets around the world. And it's obvious that that's what was going to happen.
But, yeah, it's very similar to what they did with Argentina. So, yeah.
But yeah, and this goes back to what we were talking about right at the beginning of the program. And it's the assault against national sovereignty, against sovereign independent governments, autonomous governments that resist U.S. policy, is both relentless and extremely broad. It covers all kinds of fronts. And this case, the Crystal X case, in which a U.S. court has authorized Crystal X to go after CITGO and sequester the property and assets of CITGO in order to recover the $1.2 billion that was awarded them, as far as I can see, in a completely illicit way. It would be interesting to see what Venezuela's lawyers had to say about it all.
Yeah,
and the nitty gritty is that Venezuela is under a broad and deep and relentless attack from the United States authorities and its allies, and they're going to use every means possible to deny Venezuela income and assets that the country needs in order to resist the sanctions and so forth that the United States and its allies are applying.
Right.
So going back to what you said, as you're quite right to point out that this comes immediately after the assassination attempt against Nicolas Maduro, which is being played down very much so in the Western media, United States and Western European media, and in the right-wing Latin American media. And they're trying to pretend that it wasn't very important, or it was staged by Maduro and the Venezuelan authorities themselves. I mean, they're coming out with all kinds of reasons to dismiss the assassination attempt against Nicolas Maduro as something that's not very important, but it's absolutely crucial in terms of Venezuela's, certainly in terms of its internal politics, because if it had succeeded, it would have been a devastating blow to Venezuela's ability to maintain itself as a stable society, because it would provoke widespread political violence across the country. But thankfully, that didn't happen. And what's happened internally in Venezuela is that, in fact, the coup attempt has strengthened Nicolas Maduro's hand in terms of his ability to push through the very difficult economic reforms that he's trying to introduce to address deep-lying structural economic problems in the Venezuelan economy, fundamentally to reduce the dependence on oil and to reduce the ability of foreign speculators and the smugglers, the contraband mafias along the Colombian border with Venezuela, to to take away from them the tools that they've been able to use to destabilize Venezuela's economy, really, over the last 20 years. So, and that's the, in a way, the assassination attempt was very opportune, because by intensifying the assault against the Venezuelan state, the United States authorities and their local allies in the Colombian oligarchy and in the Venezuelan opposition have actually strengthened Maduro's hand.
That's right.
And so then we'll have to see what happens in relation to that. But in the actual investigation into that assassination attempt clearly indicates links between the Colombian authorities, who at the very least facilitated the logistics that made the attack possible, and also a direct links to Julio Borges, who is one of the main leaders of Venezuela's political opposition. So, and another thing that makes the Crystal X case against Venezuela relevant in terms of its timing is how you can see that it could very easily be used against Nicaragua as the economic sanctions develop against Nicaragua. Because here in Nicaragua, the crisis that lasted from mid-April until mid-July, essentially a coup d'etat in which the political opposition that has been unable to achieve political power by the electoral route, attempted and the insurrectional route, and tried to impose a kind of coup d'etat demanding the resignation of the government, and that failed. So what's gained, just as it did in Venezuela and in its different versions in Venezuela, so now what's going to happen in Nicaragua is going to be a replay of exactly what the United States has done to Venezuela. They already have legislation prepared in the US Congress that actually strengthened the original program of the NECA Act. The NECA Act was mooted in 2016, I think, and has gone through various versions, all of which attempted to or proposed making it impossible for Nicaragua to get preferential loans in international financial institutions. But now the measures in Congress are likely to be broader than that, and also will be linked to the implementation of the Magnitsky Act against people in Nicaragua. Two or three individuals have already been targeted by the United States authorities using the Magnitsky Act, and that we can expect cases very similar to the Crystal X case to occur over the next year, 18 months, 2 years, as the U.S. government tries to apply the economic screws to Nicaragua.
Yeah. I mean, this is, if it works for them, they're going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
We've discussed the, over long period, in essence, the, some of the dialectical character, basically, of these retrenchments by the right. In Argentina, for example, with the election of Macri, you end up going back to the future, where they...
Absolutely.
Yeah, they install the same quote-unquote reforms, this basically the same looting regime that impoverished the country, a generation earlier, and led to the leftist governments. And as they try to undo the gains made by these leftist governments around the region, they put people in the same position as before, which gives rise to leftist governments. And while they're doing it in Venezuela, they're really compelling the government to get more and more aggressive on behalf of the people.
Yeah. And what we're likely to see as well is an intensification of exactly the same kind of psychological warfare campaign, diplomatic campaign, economic campaign against Bolivia. Yeah. Because I know that over the next year or so, and I think there's going to be a campaign for the re-election of Evo Morales. I have to check which year they have their presidential elections.
Yep.
So, and in in a way, and we keep going back to this theme, don't we, that the in a way it's the United States and its allies and the its local proxies in the regional oligarchies in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. They're up against the clock. They know their influence is running out, and they just have to impose control as much as they can in the time that's available to them before they are forced to make it reach an accommodation with the global rivals like China, the Russian Federation, among others.
That's right, and we're seeing that more or less that's coming to pass in a variety of places. And as China integrates, in essence, this whole Eurasian, thing that's coming into being, the Silk Road and the String of Pearls and all of that, as that actually becomes living tissue, as it becomes an economic contraption, a new economic entity, it's the ability to offer positive benefits to people in Latin America and Africa and elsewhere only increases substantially, and it drives, in essence, as an example and also just as a material fact, the possibility of building the infrastructure in Africa and Latin America that's been so sorely neglected over the last two centuries, really, except for what's been carried off, as plunder. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling, prophecy that the fear by the West of losing the world to the world's people, as they try to protect themselves from it, in fact, almost everything that they do helps to actualize it. We got to stop there. We're out of time. Tony, thank you so much for your time this week, and we look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. As a popular American song goes, there is no justice in the world, and the Palestinians may know it better than anyone else. Expelled from the land, fed with empty statehood promises for 70 years, and now shot at and killed en masse for the sake of providing security for Israel. Is that likely to prompt any international response beyond the standard condemnations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Saeb Erekat, Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Erekat, it's good to talk to you at this critical moment. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, first of all, let me express our deep felt condolences and just as deeply felt rage at the mass killing on the Gaza border. Is there anything at this point that you can do to stop it?
First of all, I appreciate your kindness and your understanding of the situation and your condolences to the Palestinian people. We have witnessed a real massacre. 64 people were killed, totally unarmed, in their land. None of them crossed Israel. And then the Israeli army killed 64 and wounded 2,500 mm-hmm. in the West Bank and Gaza. Mm-hmm. And the line that we hear from Israel is that Israel defend itself. I don't know, defend itself against what and against whom. And then the United States, now Nikki Haley, the ambassador of the United States, really is becoming to be the spokesperson of the Israeli government. And this American administration is really throwing this region down the path of extremism, violence, and counter violence and bloodshed.
Let's not diminish it only to the United States as Israel. Obviously, there is also an international community, and you cannot say that it has entirely turned a blind eye to what has happened. A number of countries have recalled their ambassadors. The UN human rights spokesman called the Monday violence appalling and deadly. The Europeans, including the Russians, expressed condemnation. Do you think, though, this reaction is proportionate to what has happened? As you pointed out, more than 60 people killed on one day and more than 2,700 injured.
Well, first of all, we appreciate the support of the international community. We support those countries who stood tall and stood shoulder to shoulder with the Palestinian people in their moment of sadness and darkness, who stood tall to condemn the Israeli massacres and war crimes being committed here. And that's, I think, the majority of the nations of Earth have expressed their condemnation of such act. Then, after the condemnation, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Now, since March 30th till now, we have 104 Palestinians killed, mostly women and children, 5,000 wounded. What do we do tomorrow? Israel feels immune. And at the end of the day, we have done everything humanly possible as Palestinians, as a leadership here, to achieve peace with Israel. We have recognized Israel's right to exist on the 67 lines. We have accepted the two-state solution. We have worked so hard with the quartet, Americans, Russian, European Union, and the United Nations to achieve peace. But the Israeli government refused the two-state solution, refused the creation of a Palestinian state, continued to build settlements and dictation on the ground. And then comes the United States administration to support all the Israeli moves and steps and to dictate on us, thus throwing international diplomacy towards chaos, lawlessness, and anarchy.
Now, Mr. Erekat, as I said in my introduction, this is a hugely, hugely unfair world. And this is not the first time that the Israelis resorted to such disproportionate and, in my view, callous violence against your people. But let me repeat my question again. Do you think there's anything that other countries can do to change that? What exactly you would like to see Russia, the European Union, China, any of your supporters in the Arab world to do at this point?
I would like the people who stand with international law, the countries that stand to defend international law, like Russia, China, the European Union, the organizations like the UN and other countries, to hold Israel accountable. They cannot continue business as usual with Israel. They cannot continue receiving Israeli prime ministers in their capitals. They cannot continue their trade with Israel as long as they do these things. Israel must be held accountable. If any country on earth does this to its people and to the people, to their neighbors, what would the international community do? Now, this government feels immune, feels that people, khalas, one statement condemning, saying it's bad, and then in the Security Council we have an American veto, in the General Assembly we have resolutions that are never implemented. So if you want me to be very frank, I want these nations, because to stand tall and hold the Israeli government accountable. Now, we have made a referral for the International Criminal Court. We want the help of the members of the International Criminal Court to help us open an official investigation in these war crimes against the Israeli Prime Minister and Defense Minister and other Israeli officials. We have a case now in the Human Rights Council calling for an investigation committee. We want the support of the international community to send and compel Israel to accept this investigation committee to begin its work. That's what we need. But then, you know, if Israel feels that they can continue building settlements, massacring Palestinians, and then it's business as usual, and their occupation and their demolishing of homes and collective punishment, and then business as usual. If I say this, people will tell me, oh, this is not realistic. How can we be part of making peace while we treat Israel like this? Israel has a government that is non-partner. We don't have a partner in Israel for peace anymore. This Israeli government is there to destroy the two-state solution and to destroy hope for peace.
Mr. Erekat, you made it clear on a number of occasions that you do not see the United States as an honest or independent peace broker. And I think many people, at least in Moscow, would totally agree to that. But with the United States absent, who can possibly compel? And this is a painful question, but I have to ask you, who can possibly compel Israel to negotiate in good faith or even sees what doing what it's doing?
That's up to the international community. That's up to the moral standards of nations. If they want this region, because who's benefiting now from such actions of Israel and the United States? The United States is not only not a partner. They cannot be a partner. They are not a broker. They have taken the seats of Netanyahu. They are dictating the solution. They are throwing this region towards lawlessness. Extremists in this region have been strengthened and provided with ammunition by these American and Israeli decisions and actions more than any time before. Moderates in the Arab world, people like me, have been destroyed. So the nations of the world, if they can't get through the Security Council, if they can't get through the International Criminal Court, if they can't do anything about their trade, that means you're telling the Arab people the only way for you is to use violence. The only way for you is to support extremism. And that's what we've been fighting against as Arabs, because we want to live and let live. We want human rights. We want human rights, women's rights, democracy, the rule of law. We want peace. But with such action, such fascism, such apartheid being exercised by Israel and Israel getting away with it, I think this is opening the gate of hell in this region.
Speaking about who is benefiting from it, I think there is a deliberate effort on the Israeli side now to paint all the Gaza protesters as a Hamas mob, which they clearly weren't. Having said that, do you think there's any truth to the argument that Hamas may find these demonstrations and the ensuing violence a welcome distraction, allowing it to refocus the growing frustration with that same group in Gaza into anger against Israel?
Well, I don't, you know, this is the Israeli argument. All the time, Israel is defending itself. How many Israelis were wounded? How many Israelis were killed? How many Israelis were threatened? None. Hamas has nothing to do with this demonstration. There are people from all spectrum of Palestinian civic society. Your reporters are there. Did you see a single Palestinian in these demonstrations with a gun, with a weapon, with anything? Nothing. Women and children and men and all from civic societies, from all Palestinian factions, from all parts of the world. But then Israel's line is that Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah threatened destruction of Israel. They're destroying. They're hitting Syria. They're hitting Lebanon. They're killing the Palestinians. And then they claim to be the victims. And that's the irony. That's the irony of fascism. We have seen such pretext given by all fascists who went throughout this history. Israel is killing and destroying a Palestinian civilian population under occupation, under Israeli occupation, under international law. Civilians should be protected, and the international community must move in the direction of providing international protection for Palestinians.
Mr. Erekat, as you mentioned, we do have reporters on the ground, and most of them are attest to the very indeed peaceful nature of this protest. They say that given how many people have participated in the demonstrations, they were actually surprised how placid those demonstrations were on the Palestinian side. But I also have to know that there have been reports of some young men bringing knives and fence cutters to the demonstrations. There were also reports of calls over the loudspeakers to burst through the fence. And I just wonder, what do you think would be the proportionate reaction from the Israeli side to those kind of actions?
Let's say that people cross the line, okay? Which, by the way, there is no line because Israel did not define its borders yet.
But you know there is a fence there, and there are Israeli soldiers guarding that fence.
The fence is self-imposed, is self-created. Israel has not declared its borders yet. That's the question. But when we saw the refugees coming from the Middle East towards Europe, tens of thousands. Did you hear of any people being killed in Russia or in Holland or in Germany or in France or in Britain? Yeah, if Palestinians cross the line, you can arrest them. You can arrest them. You don't have to open gunfire. And we have pictures of Israeli soldiers killing our kids and our boys and girls and then celebrating, clapping, express their happiness. These are war crimes. These are murderers. I cannot accept any pretext other than saying that they're defending. How can they defend themselves? To use the pretext of such massacres, I think the message is very clear. I think the message is telling Palestinians, we're here to stay as your occupiers. We're going to blockade Gaza. We're going to continue our control in the West Bank. We're going to continue our settlements. We have the full support of this American administration, the Trump administration, which is really throwing the whole world toward chaos and lawlessness and extremism in its actions. And then those nations, there are 194 nations on Earth. Not a single nation without a problem in its social, demographic fabric or geographic fabric. So if we're going to go on the path of lawlessness that Trump is pursuing, the result will be chaos, lawlessness, the rule of the jungle, violence and counter-violence and bloodshed and extremism. Is that what we want? Is that what Europe wants? What Russia wants? What China wants?
Mr. Erica, this is obviously not what we want, but unfortunately the world has been allowing this for a number of years, if not decades already. Let me ask you one very specific question on May 14th events, because the protests in on the Gaza border, let's call it border, around the Gaza fence, had been ongoing for more than a month. There were victims and casualties before, dozens of people killed, and yet the majority of the casualties occurred on that specific day of Israel's founding and the opening of the Israeli of the American embassy in Jerusalem. Do you find this fact that the majority of casualties occurred on May 14th, a tragic, sad coincidence, or do you indeed think that the Israeli army was tasked with being more forceful with using live fire on that specific occasion?
Well, exactly. Yani, the Palestinians, yani, President Trump came, there is a fire, and then he poured fuel on the fire. The Americans, instead of being the firemen, they became the arsonists. And that's the meaning of the opening of the embassy in East Jerusalem. It's like establishing a new settlement outpost in occupied territories. And then the message from Israel, okay, we have the United States here, and look at what we're doing. We're massacring Palestinians. And then in the United Nations, there are two Israeli ambassadors, one named Dannon and one named Haley, and we will blame the Palestinians. We'll blame the Palestinians, we will export fear and so on. And I don't think that the international community has a neon in their forehead saying stupid. Because the lack of reaction of the international community is a real threat, is a real threat to the stability and security of all nations. Extreme blood will breed blood, violence will breed violence. Desperation will lead to desperate acts. And what Israel is doing now in destroying a Palestinian life, social life, economic life, making people hopeless, what will they be creating? I'm a father of four, a grandfather of seven. I don't want them to be suicide bombers. I want them to be like your children in Russia, like the children in Sweden, like the children in the United States. I want them to be normal people. With such massacres, with such crimes, and Israel getting away with it, what you're doing is totally paving the way for the gates of hell to open in this region.
Well, Mr. Erekat, let me stop you there. We have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Saeb Erekat, Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mr. Erekat, there is some effort on the part of the former U.S. administration, the Obama administration, to try to convince its European allies to essentially hold on for a few years until Trump is voted out of office. You know, this idea that one day normality will return. I wonder if that is the perspective that you take as well, that this current American predisposition, which is clearly harmful and unfair to your cause, that it is only temporary.
Well, look, we had meetings with the Trump administration in 2017, 35 times, including four summits between our president and President Trump. And I held personally 31 other meetings with them as negotiations. We gave them every possible chance. With their decision in declaring Israel as capital of Israel, they disqualified themselves from any role in the peace process. We will not sit with them. They're not partners. They're not only biased. They're adopting the Israeli position of dictation and not negotiations. And, you know, once Franklin D. Roosevelt said the White House is an office of international morality. An office of international morality needs giant statesmen, not real estate agents. This administration cannot be a partner. And of course, our only option is to stay on this land and to be in this land. Today, between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, we are the majority. As Palestinian Arabs, Palestinian Christian and Muslim Arabs, we're 50.9%. Jews are 49.1%. What are they going to do with us? Other than creating extremism, and then, you know, when violence spread and people are being killed on both sides, then Israel will say, oh, these people have it in their DNA, they're terrorists and so on. I have devoted 25 years of my life in negotiations with Israel to save lives of Israelis and Palestinians, to live and let live. We have recognized Israel's right to exist. We have accepted a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as capital to live side by side in peace and security with the state of Israel in the 1967 lines. What did Israel do in return? More settlements, more dictations, more killing, more murders, more siege, more closures, more collective punishments, home demolitions. All these actions are being done in 2018 by a member of the UN. And they call it the only democracy in the world. This is it's fascism. Yani never in the history of South Africa, darkest hours of apartheid, were blacks prevented to use roads white were using. Today there are in the West Bank and East Jerusalem roads we cannot use as Palestinians. And such diseases as bigotry and racism, once they inflict underneath our skins of any kind, of any race, of any religion, we had a tendency to justify it. Sometimes we give sociological, psychological, economic, sexual explanations. And now Israel is using the pretext security to justify its apartheid system being created in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And this must stop. And this, we will stand up. We will not depart. This is our land. And we will defend ourselves.
Mr. Arakat, let me ask you one more question. I know that you believe that Trump's announcement and his decision to move the American embassy to Jerusalem was essentially the end of the two-state solution. That's at least what you said on record. And I also heard you say that Trump's decision would force the Palestinians to strive for quote-unquote historic Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, which is another way of saying that you two not only reject the two-state solution, but you actually don't recognize Israel's right to exist on those territories. I understand the emotions behind that statement. I understand them. But do you think it can bring your people any good in practical terms?
Look, what I said our option is a two-state solution. Our option is to live and let live. Our option is for the state of Israel, which we recognized on the 1967 lines, to live side by side in peace and security with the state of Palestine. That's what we said. Now, Israel did not recognize the Palestinian state, refused to stop settlements, and so on. So we're left with two options. If Israel is destroying the two-state solution, and Benjamin Netanyahu personally is in office for the last 9 years destroying the two-state solution, and now Trump came to help him in order to bury the two-state solution, we're left with two options. One is Netanyahu's option, one state, two systems, apartheid. This will not be accepted to us. The second option is one state, equal rights for Jews, Muslims, and Christians to live together. That's a very civilized solution, but the Israelis will never accept it. So if Israel destroys the two-state solution, and if the option of apartheid is not doable for the Palestinians, and if the option of one state, equal rights, is not doable for the Israelis, what would this leave Palestinians and Israelis with?
I think this narrative of historic Palestine is definitely becoming more popular among the Palestinian officials. Just the other day, Mahmoud Abbas said that Palestine is for the Palestinians. It is not, as the Jews claim, the land of their ancestors. So he does seem to be questioning Israel's right to exist on those lands. And I wonder if that does not make it easier for Israel to paint you as anti-Semitic rejectionists.
President Mahmoud Abbas went to the Security Council in February 20th, 2018. And in his speech last week at the Palestine National Council, reiterated our commitment to the two-state solution, where the state of Palestine, with East Jerusalem as its capital, will live side by side in peace and security with the state of Israel. And he called for a convening of an international conference. And he was willing to come to Moscow upon the invitation of President Putin to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And Prime Minister Netanyahu refused the invitation of President Putin twice, not once, twice. And President Abbas accepted. We are with the two-state solution. We recognized Israel. Israel did not recognize us. Since 1988, we have accepted resolutions 242 and 338 and recognized Israel. And since 1988, Israel has done nothing but to dictate settlements on the land that's supposed to be a Palestinian state. That's the reality. That's the reality. We never abandoned the two-state solution. The two-state solution is our line, is our vision, is to live and let live, because we know, we're realists. This is the only way for Palestinians and Israelis, is to have two states to live side by side in peace and security next to each other. Now, who's destroying the two-state solution? Who's building settlements in the supposed to be a Palestinian state on the hour every hour? Who's dictating the fate of Jerusalem other than Trump and Netanyahu? Who's using the collective punishment and military means? Can you solve a political problem with military means? You can't. You can't. So all these things, our position is that we have recognized Israel, and this stands. Israel refuses the two-state solution. President Trump never mentioned two states. He mentioned it in the context that if both parties agreed, he gave a veto to Netanyahu. The administrations of the United States since 67 considered East Jerusalem as occupied territories. Now they said we recognize Jerusalem as defined by the government of Israel. That means they have abandoned their line that East Jerusalem is occupied territory. So what do you do in such case? I think this region is being thrown to the hands of extremists. I think Arab moderates are being destroyed. And I think this is the intention, the strategy. So they can say, Israel can say, oh, we're the only democracy. We want peace, but we don't have a partner for peace. And nobody will ask them, but you had a partner for peace who recognized you since 1988. And they negotiated with you for 25 years. And you did not move one inch to announce that you accept the two-state solution, or you want to recognize the Palestinian state, or stop settlements, or stop the collective punishment.
Mr. Erekat, we've talked about Israel and the United States, but I think it's also evident that one of your former strong backers in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, is also, is no longer there for you, if I may put it that way. I'm sure you've heard about this leaked conversation of the Crown Prince, Saudi Crown Prince, reportedly suggesting that the Palestinians should take what's on offer or shut up. What's your reaction to that?
This is absolutely baseless. This is not true. Last night, I was with the president when he received a phone call from His Majesty King Salman bin Abdul Aziz of Saudi Arabia. He called for an emergency session tomorrow for the Arab foreign minister. They pledged to fully support us. They denounced and condemned the Trump decision. And this is false accusation. They're trying to show to tell Palestinians that you're alone. That's a lie. We have a common Arab position. Arab may differ with each other over Syria, over Iraq, over Libya, over Yemen. But when it comes to Palestine, Arabs are united. The last summit held in Riyadh, King Salman of Saudi Arabia said it's the summit of Jerusalem in condemnation of Trump's decision. That is the truth. That's the truth. There is no Arab country that doesn't support us, fully supporting us. And that's the truth. So all these lies being spread by Netanyahu, that trying to say that they see the geopolitics of the region, that Iran is the threat, and we joined with Saudi Arabia, and we joined with the Emirates, with this, with that, that's totally, total lies. Netanyahu's occupation is destabilizing all Arab countries.
Well, Mr. Erekat, we have to leave it there. I really, really appreciate you taking time to talk to us today. And I also invite our viewers to keep this conversation going in our social media pages. I hope to see you again. Same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.